Very much indeed.
The folks were few in number, but let's see how we get on anyway, and let's use the fewness of number to make it as informal as possible, so we'll see how we go. I just want to say what I'm going to do this week, and then what I'm going to do today, and then see how it all fits together. Today I'm going to do a bit of history. My main interest all week is priestly ministry and its identity in the local church and the new developments around ministry that are taking place and that theology is trying to pick up on. Today I'm interested in history and in particular in an obscure but very important part of history, namely how there came to be a thing called a diocese. I'm interested in the genesis of the diocese historically. That's what I'm going to spend my time at in today's lectures. Obviously, Jesus didn't start a diocese. a diocese is something that came to be a particular time in the church's history, and my argument is going to be it came to be with a pastoral vision. It isn't just a structure that developed. It is a structure that developed in the service of a pastoral vision. And I'm also going to argue that that development was an enrichment of the church's own understanding of its place in the world, which cannot be gainsaid. I do not think we can leave behind the richness of the understanding of church that came to be when the developments that I'm going to be talking about today work themselves out. I'll come back to that in a minute, but that's today's work. On Wednesday, which is when I talk next, I'm going to talk about the identity of the priest in the local church and the developments of ministry around that, of other forms of ministry. On Thursday, I'm going to talk about the priest and popular religiosity. Very important thing indeed, how the priest works with sort of non-liturgical religiosity, and that's my theme for Thursday. And on Friday, I'm coming back to the theology of ministry in general as a result of all these explorations.
Is that okay?
There's a public lecture that I'm supposed to be doing on Thursday, and on that, I'm taking the theme Jesus and Politics with a view to some of the implications for ecclesiology that arise out of looking at how Jesus can be viewed in respect to where the politics question was in his time. So that's what I'm at anyway, and I'm coming back to today's work, and I just want to introduce. I'm going to use the overhead projector a fair bit on this historical material, because we're going to use some text. So I'll be hopping up and down with that, and that will probably annoy the person who is trying to record these talks over there. So let me get going then. I mean, the first thing I want to say is that if you're a priest, whether you like it or not, you're part of the history. There's a whole tradition that actually shapes us. You don't walk into the identity of being a priest and say, well, I'll decide what it is. The story was already there beforehand, and you can act creatively within the story, but there is a tradition that has been shaped, that has had decisive moments in that shaping. And it behoves us to, as it were, grasp the key moments in the shaping of our history if we are to be creative with it. I used to say to seminarians when I worked with them, being a priest is an assigned role. I mean, the role is there before you. You can't walk into a parish and say, well, I'm going to be a guru and wrap myself around with a yellow blanket and sort of say, well, I'll sit in the presbytery. I'm not going to do funerals or I'm not going to do anything like that. I'm just going to be a priest in my own term. It doesn't work like that. It's a role that has emerged in the story of the church and you take it up creatively, just as you might take up the role of Hamlet. Play it differently, but nonetheless the role is that already set in a text, as it were, or in a story or in a tradition. And that's where we are in terms of priesthood too. I myself think that the great recovery of the story of priesthood, which has occurred in our time, and you can nail Vatican II for it, is quite simply this. It's a corporate vocation. Priesthood is not something you ever do alone. It's inconceivable to think of being a priest without thinking of that as being working together in a common or corporate vocation with others. And strange as it may seem to us now, that insight was actually quite lost sight of, perhaps around the time of the Middle Ages and the scholastic definitions of priest, which would have said being a priest is having the power to celebrate the Eucharist, and did not include that being a priest is part of a corporate vocation and one celebrates the Eucharist, as we would say in today's language, within a Presbyterium. So that element of the corporate vocation is of immense importance, and this is something I'll be getting around to all week long. Now, that corporate vocation has taken institutional form in different ways, and one of the institutional forms it has taken is the diocesan presbyteriate, and that's the particular development history which I'm going to try and figure out in these lectures. I'm a religious priest, I'm a redemptorist, maybe not a very good one, but that's what I am. But redemptorists, one way or the other, are actually still linked to that diocesan presbyterian. And a redemptorist works in a diocese. And I tend to regard diocesan priests as the frontline presbyterian and religious priests as auxiliaries to it. But the essential vision of the church's priestly identity at the moment is the diocesan presbyterian. And my argument is that wasn't always in existence. Jesus didn't start out with the idea of a diocese in mind. It was a development in continuity and one which had a development of pastoral vision with it. And it's the recovery of all that that I'm going to be trying to work out in the next three lectures as they follow. Let me just roughly tell you the history course and then fill in the details afterwards, if I may do that. Roughly the history is like this. In the 4th century, the church, of course, is existing at this time in the Roman Empire, almost uniquely, although one branch of it has already gone into the Eastern European Empire and even as far as India by this stage. But mostly it's in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is a place of cities. The early Christians ignored villages. They just walked from one, Paul walked from one city to the other. They didn't even notice the villages. Around the 4th century, they began to evangelize the villages. They began to go up the mountains. They began to go into actually different languages. The Celts, for instance, and the Franks and the Germans. And it is in those developments that they begin to develop a vision of a corporate ministry which isn't so closely associated with the bishop as was the corporate ministry in the cities itself. And that's actually when the diocese begins to take place. And with that, there develops a vision of ministering in every different place in this area, even to those who are non-Catholic. And it's that in those developments we're going to be trying to work out before that. So around the 4th century, the evangelization of the villages associated with, you have a change in the sacrament of orders. But very briefly, very simplistically, priests begin to undertake episcopal functions in the various villages and mountains and among the various people that they are. Redistribution of functions takes place. That's the modern Presbyterian. Modern Presbyterians are sharing in the ministry of the bishop in an interdependent way. And the future of it lies in us all recognizing that. And that's what we're going to be getting around to. And then thirdly, so you had the evangelizing of the villages in the 4th century, you had a redistribution of functions within the sacrament of orders, and a development of the pastoral vision of the church. namely a vision of Chartreuse, the revelation of grace in various different places within this territory in which it is operating. Church existing not just for itself here, but for the sake of the revelation of grace among these peoples. And that's what I'm going to be trying to work out in the course of these lectures. Is that okay so far? Can you see what I'm trying to get at? And it's not a very often traveled part of history, but you find it worked out very well in the books of Schinnebeck, especially the book Ministry's second book. He has worked it out very well. And the recovery of it, I think, eventually helps us, I hope anyway, as we go along, to understand something about how we might meet the challenges of the church today, where there was a huge decline in priestly vocations, and where the pastoral vision has developed in these epochs that I've been trying to work out, must not be lost sight of. There's a real danger of moving back to a narrower pastoral vision in a time when there is a great crisis of priestly vocation, and the whole thing is to try and keep the larger vision by being creative with the developments that we've had. Is that okay? I'm going to take a slight interlude now, just before going into history, because I felt I'd try too much history on Monday morning at 8:45, if you don't mind. Nobody in Ireland would even be up at this hour of the morning, never mind lecturing on theology and history. I thought I'd better take a slight backtrack into statistics. I just wanted to look at where the church is in terms of people on the ground and the kind of changes that are intimated by the demography of people in ministry today. It's very, very interesting in itself. All these statistics are taken from the official Vatican Statistical Yearbook. The version I have is 1994. And they show us, you see, what I'm trying to get at all the time is, we have a vision of church that has been seriously forged in the developments that I'm going to be talking about. And we have a crisis in handling it, because basically we have a crisis in education. And one of the great needs is to recover the vision in order to know how to be creative with the crisis. So here's a few statistics to entertain you before I launch into the history. Now I'm going to have to move away from this microphone and down to that, but that's not my problem. Okay, now does this thing go on as the next thing? It does, yeah. So I'm going to go back to the mic, even though I can't see the statistics in here, it's going to be awkward. I think I talked through them without doing that. Yeah. It's just that somebody's trying to record this, so. You need to be an American to follow these things. Excuse me. So, if you were to look at this statistical yearbook, they would tell you that the number of pastoral centers worldwide in the church. That's where this is going to be gathered. Break down into three different categories: parishes, mission posts, and other pastoral centers. I'll show you a definition in a minute, if you like, of what they mean by pastoral centers. Basically means a certain territory with its own people, its own church, and normally its own priest. So they break down into these three categories. And here's the total number of pastoral centers worldwide in the Catholic Church gathered up in 1994. You have 220,000-odd parishes, 112,000-odd mission posts, and 90 other pastoral centers. Other pastoral centers are sometimes an area of a parish which has a chapel of ease, but has really got a distinctive identity of its own. Some of you might be familiar with those kinds of situations. Now, the next statistic, as I say, these are from the Annuarium Statisticum Ecclesiae 1994. So they're very sort of official in that line. The next statistic, these are very simple statistics, but they show you roughly where things are at. Without a resident priest. Now the basic notion here is that there should be a resident priest in each pastoral center. It's got its own distinctive people, it's got its own distinctive church. You know, it has been in existence for, it has a story. If you have a church, you have a story because someone had to build it, someone had to collect funds for it, and it should have a resident priest. And now when you look at this, this really shows you how a lot of creativity is absolutely necessary in the church as we're now entering whenever it is, the end of the 20th century. So without a resident priest, you have 59,000 parishes worldwide, or 39,000 parishes worldwide. As you'd expect, you'd have an even greater number of mission posts, thus 111,000 mission posts without a resident priest. Now, this does not refer to a situation that some of you may be familiar with, where you have a parish, say, in Africa, and several little villages around it. That's not the kind of mission post they have in mind here. What they have in mind here is a mission post that has been evangelized with its own people, and it would, in fact, mean many centers. There would be many different villages connected under the title of one single mission post. And those are, 111 of them are without priests, and 60-odd thousand of the other pastoral centers. So that means there's 229,000 of the official pastoral centers of the Catholic Church in 1994 without a resident priest. 229. And that is out of a total of 429. Now you can be working on your little gadgets and work out the percentage of that, but it is clearly less than 50%. Less than 50% of the official pastoral units do not have a resident priest. And that is really the driving force of the creativity in ministry and in theology. That those statistics tell the story of why there is important changes breeding in different ways in different countries, and why it simply has to be so. So I'm just going to use a few more of these just to illustrate this point. And that is why I think, this bespeaks an era where there has to be creativity. New responses have to arise. It simply is it would mean that the Spirit had deserted us if there wasn't to be a new epoch. I mean, if you do look at the history of priestly ministry, you do not look at Jesus founded everything, and we've been continuing on exactly since. You find Jesus founded priestly ministry, and it continued to be creative. It continued to have new developments in response to new pastoral situations. I'm just roughly saying this is a new pastoral situation, and new responses to it are afoot. I mean, we're not going to create them up here this week, but they're actually happening in different countries in different ways. But in that context, in my book, it's really important to recover the pastoral vision of the diocese so that as it changes, it does not change into a more narrow vision. And that's really the aim that I have in a lot of the work I'm doing this week. Just a few more statistics before you faint early in the morning. Again, these are all from the official yearbook. Worldwide, there are 375 parishes. They concentrate a lot on parishes of distinct mission stations and other pastoral centers. 375 entrusted to deacons, and 85 of those are actually in the US. Now, whatever that means, it is an official thing. So when they go looking for official statistics, they say, here is a parish of West End, Long Branch, or whatever, and it is entrusted to a deacon. Now, that means he has administrative care of it, essentially. The sacramental care of it will always have to include the work of a priest, naturally, for the Eucharist and so on and so forth, but the deacon has the administrative care of it. You go back into history, you find that that's a very, very important. Administrative care is a very important part of pastoral care. Administrative care includes funds, for instance. In case you don't know, that's very, very important. Communities, care of the community's funds is a highly important thing. It also includes soundness of doctrine and soundness of understanding of the faith. So sacramental care is important, but so is administrative care. And they're entrusted to deacons. 1,109 are entrusted to sisters, who, in case you don't know, are women. So there's 1,109 parishes of the church worldwide and administratively entrusted to women. Now, this is a statistic you simply would not have found, we'll say 10 or 15 years ago. It might actually have been happening 10 or 15 years ago, but people would have not been able, as it were, to write in its significance. And 402 of those are in the US. The little green figure here refers to Europe. And the reason why I picked those two particular branches was to show you that these developments are in churches long established. They're not just simply in Latin America or missionary churches of that kind. 1,474 are entrusted to lay people, and 171 of those. Now that again you'll see the significance of this. Lay people. The thing there is the person in administration not intended to be someone who is connected with orders? So if we have the administration officially entrusted to lay people, are we talking about a new kind of ministry for lay people, which would have to impinge upon the way we think theologically about lay people? And the answer to that is clearly yes. There is developments in the theology of lay ministry that cause us to be much more creative about that theology than we have ever been before. And finally, 116 of them entrusted to brothers. So I'm just going to do a few more slides working out the statistics or the significance of this, and then go back to my history. This is my way of entertaining you so that you won't die before the history bit comes up. Approximately half of all the administrative units do not have a resident priest. And if you listen to the history bit, particularly, for instance, Paul and Paul's later letters, he is tremendously worried about who is administering. He's more worried about who the administrator is than about who the sacramental person is, Paul is. When Paul says that you must appoint presbyters in every parish, he describes the presbyter as somebody who knows how to run his household well and therefore knows how to run the community well, who takes care of the community funds, who is sound in teaching, and who has a reputation locally. He's tremendously concerned with that person who can hold the community together in a way that we could describe as administrative. So don't do the mistake which we're tending to do of saying that it's the sacramental ministry that alone is the key issue in the well-being of the church. Historically, two ministries are sacramental and administrative pastoral. And they together are the key elements in the well-being of the church, and changes in that regard is what the church has always done when it's up against a crisis. But administrative in the sense of someone who heads this community, looks to its funds, and keeps its goals in mind before it is of tremendous importance. So most social communities of the faithful have no priest in their midst, one could say from these statistics. And yet, in the early centuries, there was a norm of one priest to about every 300 faithful. And that was because they were following the Jewish pattern. So whenever they felt that their structures were getting out of line with one to every about 300 faithful, they began a major reorganization of the kind I'm going to be describing historically in a few minutes. Whereas we've got really out of line with that, and yet at the same time, we have been producing new forms of ministry, but not quite able to fit them into our theological structures. So just one or two more remarks along this line, and then back to the history. So in the midst of all of this crisis, there are new ministerial resources emerging. Deacons, sisters, lay people in a new sense, lay people with a new ministry, emerging, for which the institutional and theoretical framework of the church have often seemed ill-prepared. And that in many ways, I think, describes where we're at in terms of church ministry today. So there are indeed new ministerial sources. But how do you think of them theologically, and how do you fit them in institutionally is a major problem. So that's about as much, I think, as I'll say about the statistics for the moment, and I'll go back to looking at the history now. Anyone want to talk about that for a moment, just to give you a chance to comment on it? Yeah. Yes. I don't think it's a return to that, but it's interesting that you would mention that, because there was a tradition of lay administrative roles in the church. Now, what was the problem with the lay trustee thing? The problem with the lay trustee thing was it was too separate from the sacramental, wasn't it really? It was entirely a sort of an organization and financial responsibility that separated completely from the sacramental responsibility. So I don't think it's a return to that, Charlotte, but it's interesting to remember that we did have a church, particularly in the States actually, which had a lay administrative role in it, which was quite central, and which then developed certain problems. I think if you want to ask me for what I think is happening, and I mean other theologians would say the same thing, I think the word lay is taking on a new vocational sense. I think a distinction is emerging between baptismal and lay. In other words, I'm baptized as a childhood, in childhood. I become a lay person in this sense when I enter into a public church ministry at a certain stage of my life. Supposing at the age of 30, somebody comes along and says to me, could you become the person who would administer this community, its funds, and look to its vision? Now I become... Now, I'm not religious, you see. I haven't taken vows, so I can't divide myself up into religious. I'm not ordained, so I can't divide myself up into that. But something new, a vocation, has emerged. And it is a vocation which you have to distinguish from the general vocation of baptism. And I think the word lay ministry is now being associated not simply with baptism as such, but with the special developments that occur for some people. So some people enter into lay ministry. And you see, this is completely new. If you go back to Vatican II, lay and baptism are the same. But in fact, if these developments are happening, then the word lay means a vocation which some of the baptized undertake, who are not ordained and who are not religious. Yeah, I think you could say it like that, but lay ministry is certainly becoming something which is specific and is a vocation and occurs for some and is not simply the generic giftedness of baptism. And that's, you know, that very fine American theologian, Keenan Osborne. That's the way he's thinking of it now. Let me just try his... Sorry, Jordan, don't come in there. Yes. That's right. I think it's different. You see, look at those statistics. 1,107 parishes are entrusted to a person. Now, your parish manager is actually somebody employed by usually the parish priest of the place. And whatever functions he has in relation to finance are delegated by and overseen by the parish of the place. So he doesn't operate in that and an independent vocation and vision. So if you're a lay person in charge of a parish, you have to have a vision of the parish. You're not just simply doing the financial function within the parish team, which of which the parish priest is a center of the vision. You are the person who has the vision here. Now, you do not have the sacramental ministry, but you do have the pastoral ministry. So it's very, very important for you, who are the only person who's resident in this place, to think about who's marginalized. So that's one of the key things that a parish priest has to do. He has to worry about the boundaries all the time. Supposing somebody comes along to this layperson and says, I want my child baptized. And the layperson, who is now in charge of this parish, says, but you haven't been to church. He has to figure out that thing in the same way as a parish priest has to figure it out. Now, he better not figure it out in my book, as you'll see, by saying, buzz off. He better figure it out by saying, you're approaching the church, and there could be the mystery of God in you. And I, the lay person who's in charge of this parish, must know how to lead you from this sort of inchoate mystery of God towards articulating it. So he may not be the one who celebrates the Eucharist, but he's a long way away from your parish manager. And he has to, clearly she has to, because there's nothing in those statistics that says that it's only going to be he's, has to have what we would call formation, has to have theology, has to have a sense, has to have the kind of pastoral vision of the diocese, which I'm getting around to now. So it would be part of my theory that you cannot be a lay person in charge of a parish unless you have a diocesan vision. I've regarded that vision as the central Ephesian vision of the church, and it's one of my sort of passions to defend it against a narrowing of the vision. Narrowing of the vision would be we only exist for the good people, the baptized people, those on the register, to take with the rest of them. That is actually not the diocesan vision, but it's a great presentation in our time. Let me show you Osborne's way of putting this, just to sort of when you're sort of lecturing in theology, you must always scatter in big names so that they will be convinced. Thomas Aquinas, now and again, have to quote Paul And if you're smart enough, quote John, but I mean, all I can manage today is Osborne, so. It's a very, very fine Franciscan theologian, who I'm sure lots of you know his work well. He contrasts this view, which is goes back to the Middle Ages, of a church divided into two parts. One is clerical and one is lay. Now, that model is deep in my head, and if it's in my head, it's in your head. That's one presumption I make. It's in my DNA. I mean, we can't get away from thinking of it. It's sort of bred into us. There's just a church divided into clerics who are ordained and lay people who are not. The truth of the matter is that the church of the future will have to conceive of itself in a more complex way than that. And even that won't work, of course. It only just is in our head. Because what, for instance, are religious sisters? Are religious sisters clerics or lay? Well, they say they're lay, but then in another sense, they would not define themselves, and we would not define them as lay. So even that model was too simplistic. This would be his later, his sort of vision of where it might be going, and this is what he calls a vocational view. This is taken from Peter Osborne's book called Ministry, which is a very fine book. The church is the people of God, all of them together having the priesthood of the baptized. Every lay person exemplifies the priesthood of the baptized. Your parent exemplifies that in her parenting and in her neighborliness. Not in any specific church marked out role necessarily in the first person. She represents priesthood of the faithful in her way of life and its undertakings. Within the priesthood of the faithful, you can see the leadership of the ordained as a small group within the priesthood of the faithful having a specific identity and functions, which we'll be getting around to. You can see other vocations, such as religious vocations, within the priesthood of the faithful. And then, this is Osborne's way of putting it, a specific group of lay vocations. Not identity with the priesthood of all the faithful, but those who, without being religious and without being ordained, undertake a specific church identified ministry, such as the one that we were talking about earlier of administering a parish in the sense in which we were doing it. But now, in this way of thinking, the word lay is related to ministry and vocation, and not simply identified with the priesthood of the baptized. Some of the baptized, at some points in their life, enter into the vocation of lay ministry. That's what it comes to. He is, now this is, language is the one thing that you can't change on your own. It takes a community to change language, and it takes time to change language. And we can't change the word lay here in this room. But it's Osborne's view that that's one of the ways things will shape in the future. The word lay will indicate certain people with a vocational and specific ministry, and will no longer be used for the priesthood of all the baptized. Or perhaps in your sense it would be used in a generic way for the priesthood of all the baptized, but also in this specific way. So if you were to say to somebody, he's a lay leader of the church in the future, you would be saying, ah, he's a person with a vocation and a formation and a ministry that is quite distinctive from the other baptized. And the reason for that being that there is some new creativity taking place in ministry, which we need names for. Is that okay? And that's actually to a fair extent the way that theology should be trying to to work itself out. See, you're getting here the possibility of the lay being not simply delegated by the ordained, but with a specific vocation that can be interdependent with the ordained, just as the priest's vocation is interdependent with the bishop. Now, sometimes you get the impression that if the bishop has the ministry and we are handed a part of it, but I think the true vision is that there cannot be a bishop unless there was a Presbyterian. There's an interdependence and a unity in the undertaking, which isn't simply that of a superior delegating a portion of his responsibility to somebody else. And in a similar way in the future, the possibility is of an interdependence between those who are called in lay ministry and those who are ordained. I mean, the argument would be that unless this happens, first of all, the argument would be that this is happening. And secondly, that unless this is named and understood, the pastoral vision of the church will be greatly diminished, and indeed its work will be greatly diminished. Is that okay? Anyone want to comment on that just before I go back to a little bit of history at this stage? Yeah. Well, I think that those are the beginnings of it, but I think that you're going to get some not separation but interdependence between what I'm using the word today, administration and sacramental, and specifically in that area, that you're going to find a new interdependence with lay ministry. You're going to find pastoral centers of the church with a lay person as the main residential leader, and linked with the diocesan priest and bishop for sacramental ministry. So it's a development, but it is a fairly big jump. Fairly big jump. And there will have to be a big jump. I mean, there will simply have to be a big jump from where we are now to a church that can continue to function as a diocese. You see, if you retreat from being a diocese, all will be happy. Because then all you have to do is to have little communities of Christians. And all you have to do is keep supporting the faith of those who are already baptized and named. But a diocese, on the other hand, is something which is trying to be the revelation of grace in this place and for these people. And it demands a much greater diversity than those Baptists, for instance, and Catholics are very different than this. Catholics will always say, I'm here for the people of this place. So if you come along to me and you say, my grandmother was a Catholic, and I want my baby baptized, I think, as a diocesan priest, religious, with an interest in diocesan priest, I got to listen to you. Now, I'm not saying that I know what to do, but I am absolutely saying that that's what it means to be Catholic, that you're here for the people of this place, and not just for those who are church-going. Whereas a Baptist will say, you're not church-going, have absolutely nothing to do with you, until you have a new baptism or a very strong conversion experience. You are just a complete brick wall between us until you have, I discover Jesus. Whereas a Catholic will say, I'm here for the revelation of grace, and if you're approaching me, then I've got the problem to try and assist that revelation of grace in you. That leaves a lot of possible questions open. How do you do it? Sure, there's a lot of questions, but the task is, the vision is, I'm here for the people in this place. And I can never be sure where the boundary is. That's one of the absolutely most difficult things about being a parish priest, in the Catholic vision. The boundaries are not clear. The boundaries are very clear for the Baptist. And there is a danger that, with the crisis of vocation, whatever you could call it, we could go back to a church where the boundaries are too clear. And in my view, something absolutely essential to the church's self-understanding would have been lost. And if to do that, we need to think in these kinds of ways. Is that okay? Well, I dare launch into a little bit of the history. As I said, what I want to discover now is the genesis of the diocese as a development in the Sacrament of Orders and as a development of pastoral ministry. That's my name, the genesis of the diocese. Again, I summarize it before going into the detail of it. It happened in the 4th century, just being simplistic, but, you know, you've got to nail things down. Roughly around 350. It happened with the evangelization of the villages. And it led the people of the time to say that there needs to be a resident pastor in these villages who must have a connection with the bishop, but can no longer have the old kind of connection of the bishop, which was that they all lived together. And with that development comes a new pastoral vision, that the church is in the villages for the sake of the villagers, and not just for the sake of the baptized. It's in the village for the sake of the village, and not simply for the sake of the baptized. The Baptist would be in the village for the sake of the baptized. Catholic is in the village for the sake of the revelation of grace in this place. And the boundaries are never going to be clear again. And that's the history that I wanted to turn over briefly with you. Do you know how long this session goes on? Does it go on until... around 10:45, we'd all be dead. 9:45, yes. Okay, I'm going to start off on this then, and we'll refer to it. We'll revert to it in the next session. I'm not going to be able to divide it as neatly as I was going to do beforehand. But basically, I'm going to look at a few texts before this development. I'm going to look back at a time when the diocese didn't exist. These guys want to... I'm trying to keep it going. You want to actually melt it down. No, I'm only kidding. But I'm going to go back to basically between... until 350, there's no such thing as the diocese. A remarkable development takes place in 350. Later on, you can see the continuity. And the continuity has hidden the drama of the development from us. In other words, when it has happened, you thought it was inevitable. And you forget how creative it was. My business is to show you that it was creative. And, the record is very clear. They hummed and hawed. And they said, you can't do this. And it's a big change. And eventually they did it. And they created the diocese. So let's go back before it. And I'm going to look at two texts historically and just talk you through them with a view to showing what was there beforehand. And the texts are from Ignatius of Antioch, who died in the year 110, and Hippolytus of Rome, who died in the year 250. Just look briefly at texts in those and try and show you why neither of those had any notion of a diocese. They were completely pre-diocesan in their vision. And then gradually I changed the thing later on.
So, I'm going to use the overhead again. This is a text now from Ignatius of Antioch. I'm not going to spend ages at the historical part, but basically, he is writing from one of the most prestigious churches, Antioch, to the Christians in another church along the same part of Asia Minor in Smyrna. And he talks to them about the way the church should be run in Smyrna. And I'm going to read little bits of it and comment on it. I mean, it's difficult getting into history, but pull me up if you're not with me, because what I'm trying to make out now is Ignatius of Antioch had no understanding of what we call a diocese. I'll just start here. Abjure all factions, for they're the beginnings of evil. So clearly the church is splintering at this time. There's a terrific amount of fighting going on. Follow your bishop, every one of you, as obedient as Jesus followed the Father. So the point is going to be, well, there's lovely quotations about bishops here, they keep quoting this. There's only one sacramental leader in Antioch, and he's called a bishop. Technical word for it is monoepiscopate. There is not a bishop and an active presbyterium. There's only a bishop. He does the Eucharist, he does the baptisms, he does the confessions. There's a single figure in the Church of Antioch, a monoepiscopate. Presbyters do not function on the ground as ministers at all. They are purely a council around the bishop. Can you see what I mean? So there's only a single function. Now, where do we get then the movement to where there is a presbyterium that acts interdependently with the bishop? It was a tremendously creative move from that, and that's the whole argument that I made. Obey your clergy. The Latin word here would be presbyteroi. To, as you would the apostles. So give the deacons the same reverence that you would to a command from God. So you do have bishop, presbyters, and deacons, but if you follow it closely, you will find that the presbyters have no actual ministry. They're only a council, which is regarded as very, very important. They might have been a sort of concelebratory group with the bishop, but they didn't actually undertake any Eucharist themselves at all. It was inconceivable that a priest would walk out and say Mass. Absolutely inconceivable. A bishop said Mass, and the clergy were a council around the bishop. In fact, in Ignatius of Antioch's time, the priest is not the bishop's man at all. The deacon is the bishop's man. So when the bishop wants something done, he wouldn't dare turn to a priest. He turns to a deacon. A deacon is the assistant of a bishop. A presbyter is a council around the bishop, having no actual ministerial functions. And the move that we're going to see is a move whereby the bishop's functions, as it were, are undertaken by the presbyters in places where the bishop cannot be. And with that goes a whole vision of things. Okay, so make sure that no step affecting church is ever taken by anybody without the bishop's sanction. The bishop's love quoting the Ignatius of Antioch. The sole Eucharist you should consider valid is one that is celebrated by the bishop himself. No question of a valid Eucharist being celebrated by a presbyter. The sole Eucharist you consider valid, or some person authorized by him. So, the celebrant of the Eucharist is the bishop, and only in rare conditions could it be otherwise. Where the bishop is to be seen, let all his people be, just as where Jesus Christ we have the Catholic Church. Nor is it permissible to conduct baptisms without the bishop. So you can see how it's a single mono-episcopate church. One minister, and he is called the bishop in Ignatius of Antioch. Now, on the other hand, whatever does have his sanction can be sure of God's approval. This is the way to make certain of the soundness and validity of everything you do.
So if you look back at the church at the beginning of the second century, you do not find anything like a ministry undertaken by many different people in an interdependence, such as we are now very familiar with. The very opposite you find, a single person is, of course, it's a city, and the number of Catholics would be reckoned here to be something around 10,000 to 15,000, so it's quite a small group of people. But the vision of things is that the leader of the local church in the sacramental ministry and in the administrative ministry is the single figure called the bishop. The presbyters here are compared with the apostles, and their function is to be a council around the bishop, not to actually undertake any ministerial role themselves. So, if you just, it's just interesting to, I'm going to stop after this and then pick it up from there. But if you look at the context of why this is happening so strongly, you will find that it is the context of great dissensions within the Christian community. And just look at this section here, and I'll end with this. So this emphasis on one single person is taking place because the Christian community is fragmenting, and there's tremendous destructive arguments. So there are some who in their blindness reject him. They refuse to be persuaded by the prophets. So what is the point of my standing well in the opinion of a man who blasphemes my Lord by denying that he ever bore a real human body? So there are people going around saying that Jesus was not human, that he was some kind of spirit person, and the whole Christian community is being destroyed by that. Let nobody be under any illusion. And then he goes on, they even absent themselves from the Eucharist and the public prayers because they will not admit that the Eucharist is the self-same body of our Lord Jesus Christ. So they don't believe that the Eucharist is the body of Christ. That's the seriousness of the kind of problem that they're facing. And in that context, one person counts. And this became the vision of the church that they held fast to out of these great controversies. So, like, they went through all these controversies, they had an emphasis on one person, and they weren't going to give that up easily. So the change that took place took a lot of working to do. So they have no care for love or thought for the widow or orphan, so they don't believe that the Eucharist is the body of Christ. They don't believe that Jesus was a human being, and they have no care for the poor. And this means that the Christian community is in total disarray, and in that context, stick to the one bishop. So I'm going to leave it at that and come back and show you the changes that take place afterwards. So see you then. Thank you. All right.